Now, we come to an intense little study of paranoia, schizophrenia, and psychopathic behavior. And after that long introduction in the front of this volume, I'm already charting the caroling voices of those who will contend this story is a portrait of the author as a freakout. I assure you, this was conceived merely as a gimmick story. Aside from the fact that I said in one part of the story that Brad and Polly were almost identical twins, and later had Brad reminiscing of a time when he was 9 and Polly was 13, and that the story has been made obsolete by the recent Explorer shots, and that Twilight Zone went off the air before I came out to Hollywood and could have adapted it, which would have been the proper medium for this little tripper. Aside from all of those, this isn't a bad little suspense yarn, this thing called My Brother Polly. Impossible footsteps sounded down the catwalk. Impossible because he was alone with his brother Polly, sealed up in an experimental rocket 200,000 miles from Earth, and Polly was just waiting for an opportunity to kill him. Impossible because this was the first ship to attempt a circumnavigation of the moon, and God only knew how rough it was without Polly constantly on the stalk, trying to burn away the top of his skull. Brad Woodland pressed himself closer to the gigantic hydrazine tank, wedging himself in tighter between the tank and the bulkhead of the Resurrection 9. Silently, he prayed his brother would drop dead. The footsteps drew nearer, directly over his head now.
Brad! Brad, boy! Out, Brad! Come on out!
The deep, masculine voice of his brother struck Brad Woodland with the same terror it had held when they were both children, and Polly had delighted in beating up his brother.
Brad, come on out! We'll talk, boy! It's a long pull there and back, Brad. We got to comfort each other.
He slid his hands up the smooth, cool metal of the tank, clapping them without sound over his ears. It failed to shut out Polly's insistent, sardonic tones. Polly, that damned blaster. He bit his lip and he could feel his eyes beginning to water. This was the way it had always been. He could even remember a similar situation when he and Polly had been 9. He had taken the more brilliant of the two balloons Dad had brought home from the company outing, and Polly had chased him into the yard, yelling for a trade and threatening to beat Brad's head in. Brad had run wildly and wedged himself under the rear porch. He had lain there, terrified and shaking, seeing Polly's feet run past the porch, pause, turn, run a few steps back again, stop, and finally go out of sight around the house. Of course, Polly had taken the balloon later and had knocked him down with a hard punch in the stomach. But for those few moments, he had been safe and securely hidden, and Polly had not been able to find him. He was facing the same danger now. The years had not changed his brother. With the dim light from Control Country upship filtering down into the fuel tank compartment of the third stage, everything was weird and dusky. Dimly lit and soft-edged as in a dream. The way things had been when they had put Brad through his pre-flight mental checkup at Redstone Tower. He remembered all the hours before blastoff when he had lain in the padded troughs of the check machines getting his brain gouged. The more he thought of the inexhaustible training and checking and priming he had gone through for this most important voyage, the more bewildered he was at the thought of Polly stowing away. How his brother had done it, under the very noses of 1,000 guards, he could not imagine. But less than 1,000 miles out, he had discovered quickly enough that he was not alone on the Resurrection 9. While still strapped into his webbing, he had heard the footsteps. And when the compartment door to Control Country had slammed open and he had seen Polly's big, wedge-torsoed body poised there in the companionway, he had screamed, for there should have been no one else out here with him. Not only was this a dangerous solo flight, it was a crucial test for him. Eight ships had gone before, and eight ships had exploded in space, or crashed back to Earth, or shot off into the void, or... Eight ships before, and yet there was no reason why he should not have made it, for he was in great shape, along with the top shape of his ship. He would have made it, except...
Brad, hey, dear brother, where are you?
The footsteps clanked heavily overhead, and Brad prayed again in the cavern of his skull that Polly would not look down. For, save the area that was blocked off by the crossbeam of the overhead catwalk, he was plainly visible from above. In the dusking light that was still clear enough to see by, Brad knew that his brother could aim the blaster and char him to ashes before he could extricate himself. He pressed closer, his breath catching in his throat. The steps passed by, and Polly went farther toward the rear of the rocket. On a lower level, the whine of the spin turbos reminded Brad that without the centrifugal spin of the ship, there would be no gravity. And wouldn't that be a help to Polly? The steps receded, and Brad breathed easier again. Why had Polly done this fantastic, incredible thing? Why? Well, he knew the answer to that, too. He knew exactly what had made Polly think he could get away with the murder of his brother. He thought back, remembering the first few moments of shock and horror when the control compartment door had slammed open and Brad craned his neck around in chill apprehension. He had found himself staring into a face that was almost identical with his own. Almost identical, for Brad and Polly Woodland were twins. But there were differences, too, in eyes and voice and gesture, and when they were together they could easily be told apart. Only when one was absent did the other seem a replica of both.
"When all those flashbulbs go off at the landing," Polly had said softly, smiling at him from the compartment doorway, "everyone will be so full of hot juice and hysteria, they won't stop to think you look different. You went up alone, came back alone. Maybe they'll tell themselves, space does that to a man, sort of changes his face a little. No sweat, Brad boy, no sweat at all. You go out the lock and into the sun, and I go back to glory. How's that, Brad boy?"
Brad had been petrified with horror. The blaster had loomed enormous in his brother's clasp. He had watched the bell muzzle of it and felt the roaring blast of its power deep inside himself. He had waited a split second for Polly to pull the trigger, releasing one of the gelatin loads into the reaction chamber, and then he had defended himself. He had fallen forward and slammed his palm flat onto the light control switch. The compartment had gone instantly black. Only the stars outside the curved viewpoint had cast any light. Then, as Brad had fumbled with the snaps on the webbing, as he had lunged against the web and fallen free, tumbling to the deck, Polly had pulled the trigger. The hissing roar of the blaster had filled the compartment, and in the light of the flash his face had assumed a gargoyle cast, the eyes wide with hate, the mouth slashed open and hungry like the mouth of a killer fish, the cheeks strained across in a death grin. Brad had rolled, coming up with knees bent and hitting Polly low. His brother had cried out in pain and shock and had gone over backward. Brad had grabbed for the blaster, but Polly had fought back, stubbornly refusing to release it. Then Brad had run. He had been running ever since. 200,000 miles from Earth, he had been dodging and running and trying to escape his brother. The ship could carry itself. The astro plot made the machine almost a robot until turnover time came, and Brad knew he would not have to worry about getting back up to the control compartment before they rounded the moon. Eventually, he'd have to go up and slap a few switches, compute a few vectors, blast a few bursts, but that could wait. Right now, he had to figure a way to kill Polly before his brother got to him. Far behind him, he heard footsteps clanking down the compartment ladder. When the ship was tail down, the ladder ran vertically, but with the ship horizontal, it was a runged catwalk down the center of the section. Branching off from it were several smaller ladders leading to the compartment floors. It was down one of these offshoot ladders that Pauly was climbing now, the ladder into the hydrazine tank compartment. He was getting closer. Brad bit his lips again. He was trapped for the moment. If Pauly examined the compartment thoroughly, and why should he fail to do so, he was bound to see Brad wedged between the tanks. He had to get out of where he was before his brother came down to the deck. He edged out, keeping the round bulk of the tank between himself and the ladder. He got loose finally and heard the sound, someone jumping to land heavily. Then the footsteps started again. Brad cast an alarmed glance behind himself. The corridor stretched back for only a short distance. There was no place to go. Just more tanks and water valves to the flow-through ducts and tool closets, and abruptly, he felt a surge of relief. Had he stumbled on the solution to his nightmare that had for so long seemed destined to end only with his death? Was the tool closet his salvation? He edged down the corridor, keeping close to the tanks. In a minute, he was at the end of the corridor, his back against the closet, his hand pressed to the opener. He pulled up on it with one finger, and it slid open easily. He rummaged inside for a moment, finally coming up with a double-thread wrench. Big and blocky and steel-jawed, it was not the most powerful weapon ever invented, but it was better than no weapon at all. The hand grip felt reassuring. Brad melted back against the tanks, the wrench held tightly in his fist. He saw a shadow floating along the deck plates in the cool dusk of the compartment. He saw the shadow's arm extend, saw the blaster clearly. He raised the wrench over his head and remained poised, waiting. The shadow drew nearer, and Brad saw the toe of a boot around the tank's bulk. He drew in his breath sharply, and just at that moment, before he could bring the wrench down, the alarm went off throughout the ship. The sounding button went home, and the red alert screamed, and he knew he must get up decks to turn the ship. The shadow stopped moving and edged backward, and Brad, hardly thinking, knowing he was doomed unless he turned the ship immediately, took a quick step forward and threw the wrench. It spanged off the tank beside Pauly's head and hit the deck with a crash. Brad didn't hesitate. He was out and running, crouched low. He hit Pauly low again and kept right on moving. He was halfway up the ladder before he heard Pauly coming after him, but this time the angle of the tanks and the bulk of the ladder protected him. He raced down the long corridor, avoiding the trip stops of the ladder that lay along the floor, and hit the control country door with a crash that jarred every bone in his body. He was inside then, and slamming the door, he braced it closed with a panel chock that fastened magnetically to the floor, and he prayed Pauly couldn't get in. Then he was calculating the vectors, putting everything else from his mind for the moment and slapping home the switches and blasting the tubes in just the right way. Beneath the ship, the bloated, cratered white face of the moon passed by, wheeling and glittering in his eyes as the banks of auto-recorders and telemetering devices probed downward and took readings. Man's first manned jump around the moon. Brad Woodland stared fascinated and speechless. He wanted to yell, "Pauly, Pauly, I've done it. I've made it where the others couldn't. I've passed the moon, damn it, and here I am." But he couldn't. He watched Earth's satellite for a long, long moment, and then he realized the shattering sound he had been hearing for the past few minutes was not in his mind at all, but the compartment door being systematically blasted open. He spun just as it crashed inward, and he got a full-face view of Pauly, his brother, and the blaster just before Pauly pulled the trigger. The Dream. Youth in two parts, split like a pea pod down the center, with each section possessing a vigorous life of its own. The Alicia Party, where Brad had won the girl by his quick wit, and Polly had lost the girl because of his surly nature and quick temper. The days of wanting to speak, to say something, to get through the wall that stood between brother and brother, but always with silence. The days when Mama and Dad had looked strangely at them and asked themselves, what's the matter with those two? They've always been such good buddies. First there had been Alicia, when Brad was the wiser and Polly the angrier, then the hot rod days, and the skin diving days, and finally the high school, college, post-grad army days, then the tests for Resurrection 9. Brad, Brad, Brad. No Polly, just Brad. Polly left on the outside, a lesser shot with the Redstone missile men. Just Brad into the sky and the night and the fire with the silvered salmon that was a ship to space dedicated. That had been the way of it, with footsteps that came nearer, 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 as a face that was his face and all faces lived there in a ring of flame and fire from the blaster. Brad Woodland awoke. Somehow Polly had missed. He was still very much alive. He got to his feet, shaking. Silence shimmered through the ship, but Polly was back there somewhere. It had to be. The ship tilted. The autoplot bleated, and Brad looked at the plot tank. They were nearly home. Comm Center Redstone Tower was trying to pin them with location leads. The board was going mad. He was going to make it. Somehow he had escaped the wrath of his jealous brother who had always come second to him, always, always, and who would run also ran this time. He fell into the webbing, strapped down, and brought the flaming bulk of the Resurrection 9 in for a perfect pit landing. Man had gone around the moon and lived to report the event in person. The ship was silent in its pit. When the elevator brought Brad Woodland down from the ship, he wasted no time with the reporters. He ran instead to the little cluster of army officers who stood waiting by the ready pool and saluted sharply. They returned the salute and congratulated him. Brad Woodland did not give them a moment to finish their congratulations.
"Listen, General, I don't know how it happened, but you know my brother Polly, the one who looks like me? Somehow, he managed to smuggle himself on board at blastoff, and he tried to kill me all during the trip. He had a blaster, and he burnt away the control room door and just missed killing me. Look, General, send someone on board now to get him off. I want to prefer charges."
The General motioned swiftly to the two heavy-set medmen, and, still talking calmly, still denouncing his brother, Brad was led away. The General turned to his staff, and his face was tight with the crease lines of strain.
"After they remove the suggestion leads in his brain, he'll be back to normal," he said.
One of the reporters, who had been eavesdropping, stepped forward and impudently asked,
"Just why did you feel that you had to drive him buggy, General? Statement for the Globe?"
The General looked for a moment, as though he would like to strike the reporter. But then with an effort, he controlled himself and explained in a level voice,
"We sent up 8 ships. Each trip was a failure simply because all 8 pilots went mad. Space does that to the general run of pilots, apparently. So we hypno-conditioned Woodland to think he was in mortal danger, thus keeping his mind off the rigors of space. It worked. He dreamed up a death brother who was stalking him, and it allowed him to make the turn and get back safely with the ship. That's all I have to say."
The reporter pursed his lips, watching the crews who were bringing down the telemetering devices and autoplot parts from the ship. As they moved past to the analysis sections, the reporter said,
"So there was no brother and no blaster and nothing at all, just hallucinations, right?"
The General nodded. "Precisely."
The reporter pursed his lips again and nodded his head in agreement.
"I see, General. Then if it was in his mind, and you're sure there was no blaster on that ship?"
The General cut in. "Quite sure. We searched that ship thoroughly before takeoff to make sure there was no way he could harm himself."
The reporter resumed quickly.
"Then if it was all in his mind, General, How do you account for that?
The reporter pointed, and the general's face turned quite white as he watched one of the disassembling crews moving past with a piece of metal. It was the control compartment door, completely blasted and slagged, with the radiating white lines of glowing destruction that can be made only by a blaster.